Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library.
Kia ora, everyone, and hello, Karen.
Kia ora, Louisa.
Well, we've already talked about the Writers' Festival on coming up shortly, but I don't know if people are aware, there's also the Comedy Festival, which is overlapping with the Writers' Festival. The Comedy Festival is April 26th to 20th of May, so it's a great time to be in Auckland, isn't it, Karen?
Yeah.
And also, I was thinking, wow, these colder, you know, days that have started, it's colder and shorter. It's a great time to sort of, you know, you need that belly laugh to get you warmed up, don't you? So,
yeah.
So we thought we would talk about humorous books, and I guess with that comes funny writers or funny authors today. Preparing for today's show, as well as suffering from a cold today, I thought I'd Google best funny books and see what popped up.
Oh, very librarian technique.
Yes, well, because unfortunately, one didn't come to mind straight away for me, not really being my genre. The Curious Incident of the Dog by Mark Haddon.
Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon.
So that one rang a bell, not because I've read it, though I did attempt to. It was because my son, my youngest son, he's right from, you know, his first reads, he was always a humour writer. Captain Underpants was his love. He was no Harry Potter fan. It was always humour for him. And so I borrowed his book, thinking, oh yes, I'll see what kind of reading, you know, tickles his fancy, you know.
Sort yeah.
of just a,
tickles his funny bone too.
Yeah, see yep. if it made me laugh too, but it didn't. I gave it back to him. But it's interesting, you know, you think about, you know, reading is very much personal taste.
Yeah, and I think the thing about Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, I wouldn't call it a funny book as much as I think it's more of a quirky book, so that's the whole point, is that individuals react to different things which are quirky to them, which is a lighthearted, it's not tragic. Quirkiness is never tragic.
Yeah, to some people, quirkiness is a good laugh as well. To this day, he still enjoys comedy. And in fact, we were talking about the Comedy Festival. One of his friends are also comedians. So there you go. It's in his blood somehow. Not from his mother, maybe his father. So I just sort of give a plug for his friend, Inosi Kalavanua. His Guard Down show is April the 27th and 28th at the Q Theatre Cellar. So there you go. There you go, Inosi. So speaking of the Writers' Festival and the Comedy Festival, someone who features regularly at both is Michelle Acord. So I brought along her book, Stuff I Forgot to Tell My Daughter. It actually started off as a list of things, Michelle tells us, it started off as a list of things she should have remembered to tell her daughter, practical everyday things she should have told her daughter when she moved out of home. So she was writing all these things down to pass on to her daughter, ready for their lunch date catch-ups, and somehow it morphed into a comedy show, which she did at the 2013 Comedy Festival. Apparently people resonated with it and brought their own children along to listen to her pearls of wisdom presented as jokes. Isn't that clever?
Yeah.
So I brought along, I'm not sure if her teenage daughter paid much attention to some of this mum's musings and wisdom in the book. A lot of it seems to be for sort of an older audience. For example, I quite liked her thoughts on aging Mediterranean style. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to read a bit from the book. It may not be, you know, laugh out loud funny, but it's very clever.
I was reading, well, last time I read Michelle Acord at work, I had everybody turning around and looking at me because I was making so much noise laughing out loud. So, yeah, you've got a rapt audience in me.
Oh, cool. Here we go. I spent three delightful days frolicking topless on the Algarve coast, and it resonates with me because I remember visiting the Algarve coast, but not topless.
So we're in Spain.
Yes. So we're in Portugal.
Oh, Portugal. Sorry. Good that you
I had never which isn't actually on the Mediterranean. Here we go. I had never frolicked topless on a public beach before. Around here, we stopped frolicking topless or otherwise around the time we hit puberty and become increasingly aware, and not in a good way, that our body tells a story. A story about age, children, surgery, our genetics and our lifestyle. After 40, you are a walking autobiography, so we tend to slip up on a pleasant dust jacket to protect our real story from random eyes, sit very quietly, and leave the frolicking to the young and to the very young. And then she has a little highlight here, and it says, beauty equals what you started with, plus time.
Oh.
That is funny, isn't it?
That's good.
But not on the Mediterranean coast. Actually, the Algarve is on the Mediterranean coast. Sorry, I stand corrected. When you visit those beaches, all the books are out. I saw a veritable library of women in Faro, volumes of them, plump, stretch marked, pendulous, dimpled, sagging, wrinkled and wobbling, wandering around blissfully. Not only were the out beach wraps to protect the world from the evidence of what life has done to them and what they have done to their lives, but without their bikini tops. Mon Dieu! You might have to say that properly in French.
That was beautiful.
As they might say on the Riviera, but don't. Can I tell you how liberating this is, to completely relax under a sun with an ozone layer without still SPF'd to the max and not suck it in, cover it up or tense an ounce. Swim in red and waddle off to the bar. Yes, they sell wine at the high tide mark. It's so very European in Europe. Without hearing the word waddle resound in your head. Meanwhile, back home, 13-year-old girls swim in board shorts and T-shirts because they don't like a girl in a glossy, because they don't look like the girls in the glossy magazine. And their mothers and grandmothers don't swim at the beach at all because they're embarrassed that they've become a book. That's what happens when you are older than most of the architecture in your country. I made a promise to myself back then that I would continue to swim and frolic, and I have kept it, within the bylaws, of course, which means the top stays on. Being a woman in her 50s, in her togs, on a public beach already feels like an act of social disobedience. For civil disobedience, I occasionally conceal a little chilled wine in my water bottle and toast the woman who inspired me on the Algarve coast. There we go.
It's cool, isn't it? She's so wonderful. I just think that's, you know, that's humor with a bite. And that's what I love about Michelle Acourt. There's always a very nutted out commentary going on beneath the humor. And, you know, the thing about the European, the differences between going to the beach here and in Europe really resonated with me, because I recently was in the summer, very recently, this very summer, was in Mangafai. And I went into the little surf shop to buy, I think I'd forgotten my suit at home or something. I went in to buy a suit, and I was looking at a rack of suits, and the shop woman, shop clerk, shop girl, whatever they're called, came over and said to me, "Oh, we have this other rack over here for mature women."
Oh, cutting!
I could not believe that there was a separation. There were suits for mature women on one side that someone had determined were for mature women, mm-hmm. which were basically meant more coverage, and suits for non-mature women on the other side. And I was with an Italian who was at the beach with us, and she was astounded too. She mentions what Michelle says in that book. If you remember, she says that Europeans are so used to the wonders of the ancient, old, antique
yeah.
architecture and surroundings and landscapes that they have, that they appreciate it as a beautiful thing, different than youth, but still beautiful. She's got a new book out as well.
So she'll
be at the festival this year with her new book, which is called How We Met.
Which festival would that be then?
Maybe both.
There's not so many.
I haven't read up in the comedy festival, but she's definitely at the Writers Festival. How We Met is the
How
new
We
book.
Met. Wow, we're looking forward to that one then.
Yeah. So I've got a funny story about how I met the author of the book that I, the funny book that I brought in. So my funny book is written by Jeff Dyer. And I met Jeff Dyer at the Writers Festival, can't remember how many years ago. A few years back. And he came in, he was in the gala opening night. So the gala opening night at the festival for many years has done a true stories told live format, in which six of the seven of the most featured authors come out and tell a true story in 7 minutes. And six filed out, and then Jeff Dyer came out at the end. And he, instead of telling a story, he started giving a lecture about art. I can't remember. And he himself could not remember. He would interrupt and say he couldn't quite remember, and he'd go off to the podium and check his notes and say, let me just check my notes and adjust his glasses, and then he'd come back and talk some more. And I couldn't, and all in a very pompous way, I was saying, who is this man? And I said to the woman sitting next to me, who was English this time, not Italian, and I said, he seems so bumbling and amateurish. Is this like that English upper class thing where, you know, amateur above all, you know, to be professional is to be lower class, and like the athletes, you know, to be paid for your athleticism? And she said, no, Karen, he's from Cheltenham. So of course, with my total lack of knowledge of the English class system, I hadn't realized that he was from a working class background in Cheltenham. And funnily enough, in one of his books that I later read, he talks about how he was trying to move in on a girl at a party, and she was with a guy who did not understand that he was doing his mock pompous thing as compared to being a really pompous person. So evidently this is a thing he's used, just tried out more than once in public venues. So I actually did get to meet him at the party after opening night, and it was fascinating. It was just so funny. Really skinny, with this gelled hair, really tall, skinny as a rake, and very funny. And he writes what he describes as a mixture of criticism, commentary, and sometimes original writing, in the sense of fiction. But he calls it an in-between space that operates in the area of all three. And he does it magnificently. And he's very good at presenting the grievances. It's a sort of what I consider one of the best parts of cultural commentary, when people allow themselves to rant about, they have some grievances, they're irreverent. It's about the modern condition, and which in his case is often tied to boredom. He's done some very funny pieces on boredom. But he's never snarky, and that's I have to make a point that what I hate about some books seem really funny when you read the first few pages, and then you keep reading and you're going, this is just really snarky more than funny. Mm. And snarky is just the easiest way to be funny, because it's a superiority thing. And I think because Jeff Dyer and people that I admire who write funny things are very curious about other people, and they do not see themselves as superior to them. They want to know their stories, and then they tell it to you in a funny way. So I have a quick reading that I have prepared here, which I've called Fabulous Clothes, and it's from a journalist piece that Jeff Dyer wrote on the haute couture shows in Paris.
Oh, so we have a bit of a fashion or clothing thing going along.
Yes,
we've moved from bathing suits on the Algarve to the streets of Paris.
To the streets of Paris, to the, whatever it's called, High Fashion Week. So he's run through Galliano, Dior, et cetera, and then he says, Versace wasn't doing a show, just a presentation in a tent with a chandelier at the Ritz. It was like being in a museum in the process of formation, the exhibits consisting of a bag, a shoe, a brocaded jacket. There was one model, though, in an airy dress and a mink coat with ostrich feathers. Her hair was not hair so much as a kind of super deluxe candy floss. People regarded her in the same way tourists do the soldiers on Horse Guards Parade, peering at her while she was being photographed. One of those peers was me. I wondered what it must be like to exist in this I am seen, therefore I am trance. Her eyes were no longer the instruments of vision, merely its object. Although the compulsion to stare at her was overwhelming, it was difficult to detect her nationality, her race, even, frankly, her species. She was laboratory bred to look amazing on magazine covers. If anything, she reminded me of drag queens I'd seen a few weeks earlier at the Gay Pride March in New York. It wasn't that she looked like a man dressing up in women's clothes, but there was the same obsession with expressing an idea of femininity by its accoutrement. It was Priscilla, Queen of the Desert meets Mad Max, a combination that might one day result in a co-production called Back Home to the Future. This is my favorite line. Are you listening, Lisa? This is the clue. Surrounded by clothes displayed like museum exhibits, she looked like she had been cryogenically preserved, the sole survivor of a catastrophe so devastating that the means to bring her fully back to life were no longer quite functioning. And so she was unable to explicate the creation myth of haute couture, of which she was the embodiment and apostle.
he's so great.
And at the same time, like, this is the other thing about humorous writers. So not only do I not want them to be snarky, I like that they can also sometimes write with really strong feeling about some human and not necessarily quite so funny, sometimes very touching things. And Jeff Dyer has a part, so he does write about this coming from Cheltenham, and he was, through education, had moved out of Cheltenham and gone off to, Oxbridge. I can't remember which of the two, but when he goes home on visits or for funerals, he's always introduced as the person who is up at, and it's Cambridge, Oxbridge, whatever. But he has this one part about, so his mother, his father and his mother, he comes back to visit them. He says, "In my final year at university, I came home unexpectedly and turned up at my old primary school where my mother still worked in the canteen. She opened the door in her dinner lady's blue uniform. We both started crying and embraced each other. We held each other because we both had an inkling that part of my education was to understand that it was more than just education. I was my parents' only child, but the life I would go on to lead would be so different from theirs. And the most important part of this difference was the way that it could never be explained and articulated to them by me."
Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And I guess for so many funny people, you know, the art of writing a book and being able to express the freedom to express in words in a book is quite different for the stand-up comedian, you know, who has that pressure of
needing, you know, to keep the audience with you the whole time. Yeah.
So that perhaps that explains why so many of them do become authors. So I've got with me, and speaking of English comedians, the reverse. So Brendan O'Carroll was a writer and then sort of hit the stage. So I don't know, people will may or may not know, Brendan O'Carroll is actually Mrs. Brown from the TV show Mrs. Brown's Boys. And some of you may have seen the show that was in Auckland recently. So I didn't know this beforehand. I just know Miss Brendan or Mrs. Brown is the TV show. But apparently the show came about from a trilogy of three books that he wrote, the first being Mammy. And do you know these books?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I read Mammy, and I thought it was a wonderful book. I was trying to remember, because it was so long ago. I just moved to New Zealand, so it would have been 17 years ago. Are they set in north of England or the Ireland? I can't.
Normally has everything is set in...
We don't know.
Okay. We don't know. We'll stop there. We don't know.
We did once know. I knew.
Yeah. So it was really interesting how he came about. And he actually wrote about how the TV show came about from the books. As an intro in the latest edition of Mammy. So I wanted to read a little bit about it because it's really kind of interesting, no, I can't speak today, how things just sort of happen. Here we go. What I did have was a 5-minute comedy soap called Mrs. Brown's Boys that was running Monday to Friday on 2FM's Gareth O'Callaghan show. What a great exercise, I thought. A 20-page backstory on Mrs. Brown. So I began, well, nearly. I couldn't decide where to start. I didn't want to go back to her childhood, as that would require research into the times. So I decided to write on the day that she became a widow. So it's a bit of background to everything. Opened the pad and began. So he had bought him. He credits this pad that he bought. I think it cost him $2.50 with all of the success that he's had with the show. I expected 20 pages to take me about an hour or so. 2 weeks later, I was still writing. The 20 became 30, 40, and on and on. By the time I had finished, I'd only covered the first 9 months of her widowhood. Satisfied, I closed the pad and thought no more of it. Later on, during a phone call with my then manager, Pat Egan, I mentioned the writing. Pat called me 3 days later and told me he'd spoken to Michael O'Brien, the publisher of O'Brien Press, and they wanted the book. I protested a little. He hasn't even read it, I said, worried that it was crap. Pat replied, he doesn't care. If it's about Mrs. Brown, he wants it. And so Mammy was released a few months later and was a number one bestseller in the list for its first week. The five-minute radio series led to this book, which led to three movies, Agnes Brown starring Angelica Houston.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah.
Yeah. After that, I wrote five award-winning plays in which I play Mrs. Brown. And on it goes.
Oh, I did not realize that. So when you say he's Mrs. Brown, he was actually dressed like Mrs. Brown and talking, he was Mrs. Brown.
He
is that what you're saying?
These were followed by seven DVD movies, which between them have sold over 1 million copies. And now by Mrs. Brown Boys, which has broken audience records both on BBC One and RTE. And which includes in the cast my wife, daughter, son, sister, daughter-in-law, son-in-law, and of course me. There we go. Someone asked me the other day, how are things? And I replied truthfully, well, if they get any better, it'll be embarrassing. So the legal pad cost me $1, not $2.50. The pen, just 50 cents. That's an investment of $1.50 that has fed, educated and housed my children and my grandchildren for the last 17 years. I hope the reading of this book, because remember this is an intro into Mammy, brings you as much joy as the writing of it has brought me, and for buying it, my wife and my family thanks you as I do. Brendan O'Carroll, Dublin, 2011.
Ah, Dublin. I feel vindicated. Well, Brendan, I liked the book very much. It brought me a lot of joy. I do remember that. It's funny, the thing about the pad, because I remember I saw Haruki Murakami at the Writers' Festival a couple of years back, and he told a story about how he decided to become a writer, and he he followed a baseball team, Underdogs, and he said, I always follow the underdog, and he had gone to see his baseball team play, and there was an amazing play during the game in which the baseball came right down in front of him. It was sort of like a vision that he had, and the ball coming at him, and he managed to catch it, or the person in front of him caught it.
Anyway. You see them on television all the time.
Camera zooms in. Exactly. And after that, that was assigned to him, and he went and bought himself a pad and a pen, which were the instruments with which he then wrote his first book. And I've never really known, because I remember at the time thinking, did he really not have a pen or a pen already in his house? This was many years ago. This is pre-personal computers, I believe. But it was such a wonderful metaphor, like all of Murakami's writing.
Mm, yeah, because we always picture the author sitting at the typewriter, don't we?
Yes, yes. And we have a cult. There's also, you can look up cult websites to find out what typewriter. Was it a Remington or a Brother that your
really?
Or an Olivetti that your favorite writer wrote on? Yes. So speaking of old days and old typewriters, I have a book that was probably written with a quill pen, because it is time for our Treasures from the Basement. So for Treasures in the Basement this week, I didn't go down and wander the aisles of the basement to see what I could come across.
What?
I went down, I confess, I went down with a pre-existing idea of what I was looking for, and it was what I think is one of the funniest books ever written. It's The Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens. And funnily enough, I was introduced to this book I wasn't introduced to it. I knew about it, and I tried to read it several times, and I'd always failed, because I'm a big Dickens fan, and I'd read so many of his other novels. I just could not get through The Pickwick Papers. And it was a conversation with Paul Reynolds, who was the partner of the woman woman who explained to me about Jeff Dyer acting rather than being a pompous ass. And Paul Reynolds explained to me about the Pickwick Papers. It was his, he chose it as his funniest book when we did an event in the library where people came for their Desert Island Reads. And I said, you know, I've always tried to read the Pickwick Papers. I just can't get into it. And he said, no, Karen, you've got to read as far as Sam Weller, who's the funniest character in the book. He said, once you get Sam Weller comes into the story, just hold on until you get to Sam Weller. And then you'll see. And sure enough, even though I'm one of those people who, if I am discouraged with a book, I stop. I don't keep reading. I think it's very important. But in this case, because stimulated by Paul's challenge to me, I did read on until Sam Weller came. And then I read the book. I used to stay up till 4 in the morning reading it and think, I got to go to bed. I got to get up to work tomorrow morning. I just think it's the funniest book. And the Pickwick Papers, for those who don't know, was titled when it first came out. It came out prescient, so we're talking 1836, a new form of publishing. It was published in a journal announcing that they were going to be publishing the perambulations, perils, travels, adventures, and sporting transactions of the corresponding members of the Pickwick Club, which is totally fake. It was just a novel by Charles Dickens, a serialized novel by Charles Dickens. And it was a huge success. And Charles Dickens, as a lot of people will know, used to tour and read his books out loud. And so unfortunately, I've kind of got that. But luckily,
as authors will be doing at the Writers' Festival.
Yes.
Changed too much there.
Yeah, exactly. But even better than that is that Charles Dickens lived so long ago that there are no recordings of him reading and no one alive who heard him reading to compare my poor job at reading compared to his. So I can just go on in. But I am going to announce that I'm not going to do the Cockney accents because I'm terrible with accents. Everyone always tells me. So
you've got your own accent.
Just
going to
do it in American. I might allow myself a gentleman, which will sort of tell you where we are. So this is the story about when the Pickwick Club, who are four gentlemen, Mr. Pickwick, Mr. Snodgrass, Mr. Tupman, and Mr. Winkle. One thing about Charles Dickens is picks the best names. I don't think even in the 150 years since he's writing that anybody's ever surpassed him for names. So they've rented a chaise, a buggy, to get to a house in the country where they're going to be guests. So here's how Charles Dickens, with his wonderful powers of description and sense of humor, describes their trip in the chaise. The beginning of their trip is a long trip. So the hostler pulls up the buggy and the horse. It was a curious little green box on four wheels with a low place like a wine bin for two behind and an elevated perch for one in front, drawn by an immense brown horse displaying great symmetry of bone. An hostler stood near it, holding by the bridle another immense horse, apparently a near relative of the animal in the chaise, ready saddled for Mr. Winkle. Because Mr. Winkle had to ride on a horse because the buggy could only hold three people. A little parenthesis. So, bless my soul, said Mr. Pickwick as they stood upon the pavement while the coats were being put in. Bless my soul, who's to drive? I never thought of that. Oh, you, of course, said Mr. Tupman. Of course, said Mr. Snodgrass. I, exclaimed Mr. Pickwick. Not the slightest fear, sir, interposed the hostler. Warrant him quiet, sir. An infant in arms might drive him. He don't shy, does he? Inquired Mr. Pickwick. Shy, sir? He wouldn't shy if he was to meet a wagon load of monkeys with their tails burnt off. The last recommendation was indisputable. Mr. Tupman and Mr. Snodgrass got into the bin. Mr. Pickwick ascended to his perch and deposited his feet on a floor-clothes shelf erected beneath it for that purpose. Now, Shiny William, said the hostler to the deputy hostler, give the gentleman the ribbons. Shiny William, so called probably from his sleek hair and oily countenance, placed the reins in Mr. Pickwick's left hand and the upper hostler thrust a whip into his right. So the next line is actually, whoa, cried Mr. Pickwick, because the tall quadruped evinced a decided inclination to back up into the window. But I'm going to say whoa, because I know that we're close to the end of the show, and you told me you had a surprise for me.
Oh, Lisa? Well, just to change the tone of the show and to say good night, good evening to everyone. I've got a little joke for you. So which building is the tallest in town?
Don't know.
The library, because it has so many stories.
Oh, lovely. And so, good stories.
Yeah.
Like the ones we brought you today.
Yeah, so thank you for joining us, Ka kite anō.
program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond.
Your language.